Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Alan Cumming, and welcome to My Shelves. My shelves are sort of a museum of my life. I like to keep things from my travels that are, to me anyway, the very essence of the experiences I've had. Sort of portals, if you will, to a specific time and place. And the inspiration for stories and memories and musings. Here's a bong in the shape of a penis that my friend Eddie got while he was working as a researcher on The Graham Norton Show. You just couldn't make this up. Here's a Bill Clinton corkscrew and a Hillary Clinton nutcracker. No comment. And today, I'm talking to the lovely Bowen Yang.
I was still in the AIM chat rooms, digitally cruising in 2008. Like, this was like years after it was cool, years after people were doing it.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome.
Bowen Yang is on, as we say in show business, a roll. He has had the most incredibly successful two-year run thus far on Saturday Night Live. He is the first ever Chinese-American cast member of that show and only the third openly gay male one. He also hosts a podcast called Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers. And we first worked together properly recently on another podcast series, this time for Audible, called Hot White Heist. I directed it. It was written by Adam Goldman. And it is a sperm bank heist series. That's right, sperm. And actually, sperm, I'm going to keep saying it, sperm features very heavily in the item from Alan Cumming's shelves that I brought down today to discuss with Bowen. Bowen, do you know the thing, the item I have from my shelves today? Well, you don't know, but I'll tell you. Do you want to know?
Okay. I do, yes.
Can you hear it?
What is that?
Well, what it is, you'll never guess. It's actually a sort of like a fat, if you can imagine, a fat test tube.
Okay.
Like, I always think of a test tube as a really skinny thing, sort of like a cigar-sized test tube.
Sure.
Which has a little screw-top thing. And inside it is a milky-colored substance. And what it is that Jeremy, who I'm not sure if you met, who is the sound designer for Hot White Heist, the podcast which you starred in,
yes,
which our mutual darling friend Adam wrote and I directed.
And you directed.
He sent us at the end of the, when we finished, as a present, a really delicious cocktail that he'd, a special Hot White Heist cocktail that was in, that's white, like the sperm, which
My
is a
goodness.
Central part of the story.
Yes.
And it came in a test tube, like the test tubes of all the sperm that in the story we stole. It was so fascinating. I've never directed a sort of an oral thing before.
Sure.
And so it's so fascinating to me how attuned I am to your voice and all your little quirks in your voice.
Sure.
I almost feel I have like a fetish for your vocal skills.
Has it reached the point of fetishization, or are you, I would imagine that you're sick of it by now, just having to hear just different takes of the same lines and
no, but it's just, well, no, it actually was really, you know what I thought was really great about you? Well, many things, but one of the things I was really impressed by you about was that you, you were in the whole thing, and you worked with so many different people. And of course, hardly any of them you actually work with in real life. You know,
sure,
it's the way these things are done. I mean, there's a couple, I suppose. You worked with Bianca a couple of times, did you? Bianca,
yep,
Del Rio?
Bianca and MJ,
and
yeah.
Maybe, and then did you do stuff with some of the lesbians?
Or it was just MJ and Bianca.
MJ Rodriguez and Bianca. So I, you know, the bulk of it. You do. Anyway, you, I was very impressed by really? How you were able to, yes, but how you were able to, you know, in tune both the other actor who you weren't seeing's patterns of speech and also adjust to the sort of, because, you know, it's a funny thing, but of course it's also got, you know, highs and lows and darks and lights in terms of the vocal tone of it. I really was very impressed with you, Bowen.
What I found very remarkable about this is, I don't mean for us to just jerk each other off, but we, I mean, you, I feel like we're, because I listened back to the episodes because Adam sent me the episodes, the final cuts, I think. And then I uh-huh. listened to them and I was, there were moments where I was like, whoa, how did I think to read it that way? Or how did I do that? Or how did, like, I was like, it must have been Alan who tease that out of me because I mean,
well, it must, know, yes, I'm sure it was.
It must have been you because you know what? Because you know what I think I'm cursed with now is that working what? On a show like SNL, you, it's a sketch show, it's live, and it there's something theatrical about it in the presentation and in the style and the tone that I'm like, I think I'm forever cursed to default to a big, broad read of everything.
Well, you see, Bowen, I have to stop you there because I thought you might be like that. I actually thought
really?
That, and it makes sense to think that's a logical sort of thing. And indeed, I have worked with other you know, people who've been on SNL before, and sometimes they are like that, or they, sure. you know, they can tone it down, of course. But they're, you know, default thing because you're so used to performing in that sort of way. But you weren't like that. You really weren't. I was very impressed with you. Another reason I'm so full of admiration for you: lip syncing. And you do these great lip sync videos that you've been doing for a long time, and lip sync of various sort of films and all these different things and sort of interviews yes. and sort of classic sort of cultural moments. It's so funny because I'm curious about when you are an expert lip syncer, as you are, does it make you, are you judgy of people who claim to be lip syncers? And I'm going to preface this, or you know, prefix this by saying I am very judged. I am not a lip syncer at all, but I think I'm talking about drag queens here, and it's one of my things about club coming. My worry, my sort of worst nightmare is that club coming becomes a drag bar with bad lip syncing drag queens. I have a rule that I would much prefer that drag queens sing live at club coming. If we're going to lip sync, then you better fucking know the words, bitch. Because like, yes. how difficult is it? If that's your thing, no, don't put the microphone in front of your mouth like that so we can't see your lips. Learn the fucking thing and lip sync for your life, literally. Do it. And
literally.
It annoys me so much. It really, it's a real pet peeve of mine, Bowen. I wonder how you feel about it being, as you are, an expert lip syncer.
Well, I know it's funny to hear the business owner's perspective on this because of course you would want to curate acts and talent that would meet a standard. And yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right, because like when someone doesn't know the words, or you know, when the flaps are off, when it's unsynchronized, and literally, you know, it takes you out of it.
Yeah,
but I don't think I'm an expert. I think what those videos are a product of are me. Each one of those videos, I do like over 100 takes. Like, I mean, it's just because right. I don't want to, because I am like truly, truly keying into like if my mouth is even slightly missing what the air that's being pushed out of the person's, the original person's mouth is, if it's not mismatched, if it's just slightly out of sync, then it's trash, then it goes in the garbage. And you know,
but I admire that hugely. But it's a bit of a pressure, don't you think?
Sure, but it develops, I mean, it honestly, this sounds so silly and frivolous, but it develops a work ethic in terms of the creative process. Or not, it's not even, but this is the thing, it's not the thing, I stopped doing those because I thought, you know, this is not a generative creative thing, it is purely an interpretation of something that already exists. I'm not putting something new out into the world. And for I mean, I guess back then when I decided to not do them anymore, I was really, I had just started working in SNL, and I was being very insecure about like my output there, and I was like, god, I'm not writing at the level that I want to be writing at, and that is, and writing is the most generative thing you can do in terms of a creative life. And I was just like, I need to maybe demarcate this and not do these anymore. But
that's interesting. I sort of saw them as like a homage, though.
Sure, absolutely. It's always a tribute to what it is. Yeah.
I'm not so impressed, though, Bowen, by our other connection.
Oh, no. Okay.
Which is that in Schmigadoon, the top international Apple TV Plus.
That's the order,
So I'm in that, and I saw it. I think it's great. And you co-wrote one of the episodes.
That's right.
Which is the only episode I am not in.
Alan. Well, because you know what they did is that they consolidated some episodes. So Julie Klausner wrote a separate episode. I wrote my own episode, and for various reasons that I'm not privy to,
it was going to be more episodes, and they made it down to six, didn't they?
They made it down to six, which I'm sure is still like the I'm sure they figured it out in terms of the pacing, but that is so disappointing. But how is tell me about that. But how was that for you?
Oh, it was great. It was such fun. I really loved it. And I have seen it. And I do think it's really, really good. It's very, it's sort of, you know, charming, hilarious, witty, very witty, very, very witty and clever. And it's all these sort of, you know, both a homage and a parody of the sort of Hollywood, 1950s Hollywood musical form.
Yeah.
And also very touching as well.
Very
in certain
touching.
Ways. I mean, it's such a, you know, me and Fred Armisen become a couple. Well, spoiler alert, but and Fred Armisen become a couple. And it's actually really cute and stuff like that. But I'm intrigued about how you became involved with that, Bowen, because you were a writer on SNL first of all. You were hired first as a writer. So when you go as a writer, do you get kind of like put on to other Broadway Video, which is the parent company shows?
Yeah, it's not exclusively what happens with people, but it's very common. And Cecily and I had developed a nice rapport even in my first season there, writing. And she sort of, I think it was through her, she had mentioned to Cinco that I might have been good. I interviewed, and it was great. And then that was a very sort of. It was a very dense summer of work because I'd just come off my first season. Well, I just finished writing. So that first season at SNL, no matter what your role is there, no matter what department you're in, no matter what capacity you're working there at, it's it's a crucible of a year where you just kind of are, you know, your molecular structures like sort of reorient themselves. Like, I mean, you are a changed person by the time you're done. And I felt that way very much because it was just it was kind of my first true profession. It was like, you know, kind of a quantum leap in terms of like,
sort
I was,
of
you know,
proper growing up showbiz job.
Definitely. I was kind of just, you know, doing shows around Brooklyn at night, but I was also working a day job and then booking under fives here and there. And then, you know, that was like what I was used to for a while.
What do you mean booking under fives?
Like booking like roles that were under five lines, like on like various shows
that
shot in New York.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I think, or maybe it's like a, oh, because you've had the benefit of not having to worry about under fives, I think, in your career, Alan. But
oh
I think,
God.
But that's like a fun little thing that people are like, oh yeah, it's an under five.
Oh, it's funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah, isn't it fun? But we, I was coming off of that, and then the week after the season ended at SNL, Schmigadoon started the writers' room, and that was 10 weeks, and just a lot of us sitting around. You know how writers' rooms are. Maybe it's like you just kind of cross your arms and sort of stare at the floor for a little bit, for a lot of it, and then
blab on a lot and just kind of Bowen, I was just thinking as well that we actually have been in another program together, which is The Outs,
and that's the whole Adam Goldman connection, and The Outs, wow,
so
that
great.
Was so great, and you got to play yourself.
I played myself, which I love playing myself. That's the yes. one of the good things about getting older, and is that you get to display yourself, obviously, and also a very heightened, hilarious version of yourself.
Of course.
I played myself on a few things. I played myself in Broad City as well.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, with a lot of drag queens. So I love playing like the sort of a version of myself that I think is quite fun. And you know, I like people's idea of myself, you know, of who I am.
There's a meta commentary when you play yourself because I guess in Broad City and in The Outs, it was like the acknowledgement to the audience that like, you guys know who Alan Cumming is and that he is this figure and this fixture and isn't it fun to play in that thought space or whatever. Yeah.
I love that actually. I think that's a very, the meta-ness of it. I really do. And I've actually enjoyed that in other ways in my work in that, you know, playing versions of character, playing characters that are kind of versions of who people I think I am, or playing characters where I'm very not like that person, but by the very fact of me playing it, I'm able to wink at the audience. Yeah, do you see what I mean? That's really interesting.
Absolutely,
to me.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How did you come to know Adam?
I came to know Adam. Well, I was a fan of the first season of The Outs. I just because it had come out at a time when there was truly, it was kind of a dark age in terms of like queer media at all. And then The Outs was really kind of a thing that was this kind of life raft that I think a lot of queer people sort of just hitched themselves to.
Because it's like 2012, wasn't it?
The 2012.
The first, yeah.
It was 2012.
Where
and
were
it was
you
like,
in your life then?
I had just graduated NYU as a chemistry major, and I was in the throes of a depression because I was doing comedy as an extracurricular. I was just performing, and we would just perform throughout the city and tour in our vague little way
who's we.
It was my college improv group, and it was a lot of people who would end up working at jobs that I've worked at. The head writer of one of the head writers of SNL now is an alum of this college improv group that I was on, and then very close friends were on the sketch group and all that. So it was a very close-knit thing that it was the most meaningful thing I did in college, despite the fact that the plan was I was supposed to go to med school, but then I went to commencement, and I decided to. So at commencement at Yankee Stadium for NYU, you're supposed to sit with your school, whether it's the liberal arts thing or it's the individualized study school. I decided to sit with my friends, and I was with the Tisch kids. And I looked around.
Not even controversial.
But it was me realizing, oh, wait, I picked the wrong thing to do in college.
Boy, and that's so interesting you say that because there's a concept that I am so fascinated by. There's a playwright called David Herson who wrote a genius play called La Bête I did it centuries ago and it was done Broadway. But anyway, he's a great, great, great writer. But he wrote another play. Wrong Mountain was this play, like a man. It's basically the concept that you climb and climb and climb up this mountain, right? Oh, life is a metaphor for life. You climb up this mountain and you get to the top and you're like, oh, hooray. And then you look over and you think, oh, shit, over there, that's the mountain I was supposed to go up.
So
that's kind of what you were like in Yankee Stadium.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and I feel like that's just illustrative of life in general. I feel like there's some like Wizard of Oz tie-in too, where it's like the journey is not what
it's
a, thought
yes.
it was.
It's about the journey, not the destination and stuff like that.
But even then it's like sometimes you pour in all this, you invest all this time and energy and emotion into something that was the wrong thing in a sense. And you'd be lying to yourself if you didn't regret it just a little bit, if you didn't think, God, I fucked up. And that's how I felt. And then I was in a depression and I was like, so then my parents were like, so I decided not to go to med school. My parents were like, okay, but you better figure out how you're going to live in New York. And so I was working this temp job. And then that's when I discovered The Outs. And then years later, I semi-established myself, doing just like bar basement shows in Brooklyn doing comedy, and then wanted to produce a show that was all gay men doing an episode of Sex in the City, doing a staged adaptation of a Sex in the City episode. And then I just reached out to Adam cold, emailed him, told him what a fan I was. And then he was so generous with his time and then emailed back, was like, yeah, I'll do it. And then we just became friends through that. And then since then, we've just kind of run into each other in these very meaningful ways professionally, where I'm sure we will work together again. And I'm sure that's how you feel about him. It's like, oh, he's what a great person and great mind. Yeah.
I adored Adam. And you know, the thing is that kind of the way that you reached out to him was exactly the way that I did. So I saw the first season of The Outs, which was on, you know, just on YouTube. It was kind of the early days of those. It was one of the first sort of,
web series, actually.
Yeah. But also there was quite a lot. There became a sort of proliferation of sort of, you know, gay millennial web series. But what I thought was incredible, I always say this about Adam, and even in Hot White Heist, you know, which is a very broad, it's tender as well. There's such heart to it. And even he was able to do this kind of millennial Brooklyn people trying to find themselves sort of thing, which in some ways you think, yuck, I know exactly what that is, but you don't, right, because he does it with such heart and such sort of idiosyncrasy. Someone said, oh, you like this thing. So I watched it. And then I said on Twitter or something that I liked it. And then he kind of tweeted back and blah, blah, blah. And then I thought, you know what? I think he's a real talent. I'm going to reach out to him. I always think it's, you know, good in these situations that if you what does it cost you? And just reach out and say, truly, you know, let's have lunch. I think you're great. And so we had lunch and I thought it was charming. And then he said, oh, I said about how much I enjoyed The Outs. And then he said, oh, well, why don't you be in it? So I played myself in the first season. Then I came back in the second season, which you were in. And so I think it's a really interesting thing about seizing the moment in that way. Like now I say to people, well, like I said to you earlier, like I think it's really important to just say when you admire someone.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Not because you might get a job from them, but just because it doesn't cost you anything and it's actually makes your connection more honest and authentic and stronger.
Hello there. This is my friend Joe.
Hi.
Now, Joe plays rugby for England.
Yeah, what's your point? Come on.
Well, Joe presents a podcast and it's my firm belief that you should listen to it.
Very interesting.
And here's why. Because it's not actually a rugby podcast because, well, let's face it, there's billions of them already.
No, 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 no. It's about you, the listener, and the jobs you do. If you're a teacher, an astronaut, a tree surgeon, or a chef, then we've got loads of questions for you.
The Joe Marler Show, because everyone is interesting if you ask the right questions.
That's a great line. That is a very good line from you, Tom.
Thank you, Joe. You want to find it? Search for The Joe Marler Show in your podcast app.
Because everyone is interesting if you ask the right questions.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm curious, Bowen, pivoting on the gay theme, to your coming outness, because I read that I'm just really curious, your mum and dad found out because a computer was left open and you'd been on a chat with someone and something like that. Is that the case? What did you say? What did they see? Do you mind?
What did they see?
Like, was it something really dirty and awful?
It was so dirty. It was this was, and I feel like it was even, I was still on the AIM chat rooms, which I, with,
oh,
if,
AIM,
if you ask,
gosh.
aim, right? So if you ask anybody like to place it, to give it a year, they would say, oh, 2003, 2002, 2004, or like that range. I was doing this. I was still in the AIM chat rooms, digitally cruising in 2008. Like this was like years after it was cool, years after people were doing it, right? You know, like in a wide manner. But that's what it was. It was just me and some guy from Texas who said he was like, you know, 22 while I was like 17, which is, I mean, it's not like, I guess that is illegal. I don't know. Anyway, but
what is the age of consent now? 18?
18. Or 16. But I don't know.
Isn't it 16?
It's 18. It might be 16 in some states, but in Colorado, where I was growing up, it was 18. And then it was just, but anyway, it was in Colorado. And we were in Denver, and then my parents, yes, found this chat window. And then, I mean, after I'd seen my mother cry several times, but I'd never seen my father cry, not even when his father had passed away before. And then just coming home to them every day, this was senior year of high school, coming home to them every day, to them sobbing and just to them thinking like, there was some duty bound thing in me as like a child of immigrants where I was like, I have to fix this in some way, like, or I have to like go along with what they think is appropriate. They're both scientists. Like they're solutions oriented people in some way. They're analytical in that way.
So they wanted to fix you.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. To them it was something that sort of needed. They kind of projected onto me this idea that like you don't want this. You don't want this for yourself. And then I came home one day in the spring. My dad had pulled up this ex-gay therapist in Colorado Springs. It's a 2-hour drive each way from Denver. There was sort of some ultimatum where I could go to college out of state if I completed some 8-week sort of block with this therapist, and then I could go to NYU because my sister was already there and live with her, and she would sort of be mediating between my parents and me. And then
that's like a gay conversion therapy thing.
That's right.
And
that's
did you go to a sort of a camp thing, or was it just like a therapy?
It was just one on one. Yeah, it was just one person, and then he asked me the first session, do you want this to be secular or do you want this to be Christ-centered? That was the terminology. Ooh. Christ-centered. And I said, I guess I'll make it secular, but then the fact that like that sticks with me all these years later, because the fact that he gave me the options is giving me the illusion of choice in a way, because even if it's secular, then his, what he's being informed by is religion, you know, it's like, this is a religious thing for you, even though you are reassuring me that this methodology is not religious. Anyway, it was just a very interesting thing. And
I love Christ-centered. I think that's such a hilarious.
Christ-centered. I know. Just linguistically, it just sounds weird. But
it's like a donut or something. I don't know. There's something weird about it.
Christ-centered. Oh, and every donut, Jesus is in the center, is in the hole.
Jesus is in the hole.
Jesus is in the hole. Something that's like a pop song too. That could be
Jesus
is in the hole.
Jesus is in the hole.
Da da
da da da. Kylie Underwood would sing it.
Oh yeah.
I've known people over the years, friends, you know, whose parents have sent them to these various forms of gay conversion, and you know, one of the, and also I know a friend who kind of went undercover into one, you know, to sort of research something.
Oh, interesting.
And I found it so hilarious because some of them are, I mean, when it's the religious ones, they're so nutty and weird. But it's the ones when it's sort of things like, you know, don't wear Calvin Klein underwear. Just basically, if you don't wear Calvin Klein underwear, that is actually, you know, 75% the way to being straight. And then there was another with a lesbian that was basically giving lesbians makeup classes. And so those poor lesbians have all this plastered and all this kind of, you know, middle-aged lady makeup standing by a water fountain waiting to kind of like try and chat up boys. I mean, things like that I think are hilarious. And those actually exist. They're out there that basically, you know, if you just wear the right kind of underwear or if you put makeup on or if you, you know, do sports, I mean, people actually think that's what it takes. I find that just terrifying, actually.
It's terrifying, but you're right.
Get to the religion bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's terrifying, but like you said, funny. It's like what is like things rarely intersect at those things. And I think conversion therapy as a concept, like, is that little nexus in such a crazy way. But I mean, I only had this therapist who was honestly very insidious in a way that, like, he made it seem like it was regular talk therapy until like the fourth or fifth session, he sort of like very gradually introduced all these ideas, like sort of pathologizing my attraction to men, and just saying, you know,
had you had any therapy of any kind before that?
No, that was my first encounter. So
you thought it was just kind of like regular, just chit chat about stuff. And then suddenly it's like, wham.
Exactly. And even now looking back, I mean, there's probably some bias here because it was my first experience. But now I've had plenty of experience in therapy that is actually trying to undo and unlearn what happened in those sessions. But even now looking back, I go, but you know, this guy was really good at making it on the surface look like it was something very unthreatening, positive. Unharmful, positive, yeah.
But that's actually interesting.
Yeah, it's very
interesting.
And
how long did that last?
It was only 8 to 10 weeks, because this was the summer right before I went to college, and then I decided to go to NYU because my sister was there. And I mean, it was so funny. It's so funny that, like, go to conversion therapy, now go to the gayest private university in the country.
Yes. Did
you
feel at the end of this 8 weeks that, did you sort of think, okay, I'm not gay now, I've got it sussed, how did you think about it?
I went in thinking I'm doing this for my father, because this is something that is going to assuage something in him and my mother, and I'm doing this so that I am able to, like, have an escape plan, not an escape plan in like the dire sense, but like I need to not be in Colorado. I just need to actually
a compromise.
Exactly. And so I went in thinking this isn't real, and then midway through I was like, okay, let's just try this out. And then in the last session, my therapist kind of outed himself by accident.
He was still gay
in a way, because he was kind of trying to wrap things up by kind of giving some anecdote about, quote unquote, one of his former patients. And then he switched from the third person in the narration to the first unknowingly. And then it was very clearly a story about him, about how he months ago had pulled over at like 3 a.m. into a Denny's because his car broke down, and then he almost fucked the waiter or something, like some crazy story. But then the story he switched from talking about he my former patient to I me, and it was clearly about him. And I was like, and then that sort of broke the spell, fragile as it was when I left. And I was like, man. But then I truly, Alan, like, honest to God, gave it a shot in college, because I was like, well, my sister's watching me, I can't really be like outwardly gay.
She was like the spy, the family spy,
kind of. And it was really it was kind of shitty to put her in that place, because I don't think she would have wanted to. If she had her way, it would not have gone that way. But I went to NYU being like, well, I might as well reinvent myself because it's college, and let me just try this out. And I did think that I was in love with one girl, and like maybe years later I stand by that. But anyway. By the time my sister moved out, when she graduated, I came out to everybody.
Like,
I'm
boys. Gay.
Yeah. Oh, but it's so funny. My first apartment, Alan, was 6th Street and Avenue A. And I was right by. And every night when walking home, I would walk by
right
Eastern
by
Club Block.
Coming.
Right, yes. And back then it was Eastern Block. And I would walk by and just see all the men pour out. And I was like, God, I want to be there, you know, someday.
Because your sister, you were living with your sister then? Or?
I was living with my sister, and I was too young. I moved to New York when I was 17. Yeah, moved to the city when I was 17, and then it wasn't until senior year that I turned 21. And by then Eastern Block was, yeah. I mean, you'd obviously been right before you bought it for yourself.
Oh gosh, yeah. Eastern Block was my favorite bar in New York City. I live in East Village. Eastern Block was my favorite bar. I bought my favorite bar in the world.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love that. That's what happened. I really do.
Yeah, yeah. But when thank you so much for doing
thank
this.
You.
It's been lovely to chat to you. And it's so funny that I will always associate you. You will always be connected to in my brain, in my life, with sperm.
With sperm. That's a lovely association.
We're forever connected by male seed because of Hot Love Heist.
It's not too shabby. It's not too shabby. And Alan, it was really a dream come true to work with you. And even now to talk to you, because I've just admired you all my life. And you really You've just made so much space for us to do this. So thank you so much.
Ah, Bowen, that's so lovely. You take care. Thank you so much. Well, it's time to put my former spermy cocktail test tube away. I hope you've enjoyed this chat with the lovely Bowen, and I hope you'll join me next time on Alan Cumming's Shelves. Alan Cumming's Shelves is hosted by me, Alan Cumming, and produced by the lovely Jack Claremont. We are part of the Acast Creator Network and the Crowd Network too. We just love networks. Another Crowd Network podcast to check out is Unaccountable. It's a podcast fighting for police accountability in the United States. It's a podcast that tells the stories of innocent people who've been killed by the police, just like George Floyd, but also people like Mohammed Mohiman, Shacey House, and Carrie Illich. And so many more you haven't heard about, but you really should have. The stories can be difficult to listen to, but this could be the most important podcast you'll ever hear. It's a podcast fighting for change, and we need to join that fight. Just search for Unaccountable in your podcast app now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.